We live in the world, which is headed and run by the prince of the power of the air. But we live by the Spirit, discerning the times. For he who is spiritual discerns all things. Sharpen your discernment. Build your faith. Listen to the Word and World Team. Minister the Word of God through conversational theology, piercing the darkness of this present evil age.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Well, welcome. This is Hampton Keithley and Bob Brandon, and we are continuing our book review of Evolution's Achilles Heels. How are you today, Bob?
I'm not good, Hampton.
You're not good?
No, I'm not. I'm not one of those guys that can hide how they feel. So, I mean, I can be emotionally distant, but you would still know how I was feeling. You know what I mean? I don't know if I have a good way of explaining that, but I am on the brink of depression just looking at some of this COVID stuff. And I know we are going to get into the book. The only reason I'm bringing up some of the COVID stuff is it pertains directly to the subject of our last two podcasts, and it'll, you know, tangentially relate to today's.
Okay.
But this is one of my favorite people to read. Her name is Karen Kingston. She was embedded deeply in Big Pharma for her whole career. Very successful at what she did, and is a devout Christian. And so she is outside of Big Pharma now, but she has a mole inside Pfizer who releases information to her in the form of, you know, what you should be looking at, what you should watch out for, the patents you should examine, and this and that. And so she does that. She's not always the clearest communicator, but she is an indefatigable researcher. So this is reading from her. I subscribe to her Substack. And this is part 7 of her Substack, which reads, it's titled Dismantling COVID-19 Deceptions. The mRNA COVID-19 vaccines can't edit the human genome is a lie. That's exactly what the COVID-19 injections are doing. So this will only take maybe 5 minutes to read this, I think, but it'll be eye-opening. And I'll explain, you know, it's almost, Hampton, like when you read military material, everything's like a 3-letter abbreviation.
Right.
Medical stuff is often that way. So I'll explain, you know, the abbreviations as best I can. Here's how she starts out. Q-dot, and that's a trademark. You know, the little R with a circle around it.
Okay.
That's a trademark now in business. That's quantum dots are in the COVID-19 vaccines. So when she makes a direct statement like that, a simple sentence that's a direct statement, she's not pulling that out of thin air. She's not giving you hearsay in the Big Pharma street. She's reading the patents. Most of this article I can't read to us because it's just the patent. And that's all evident on the page. She just has photographs of the patents that all these vaccines are operating under. So she's not making that up. She doesn't think that there's Q-dot in the vaccines. That's in the patent. They are in there. So here's what that is. The primary mRNA functions of QDOT are to perform gene editing directly inside human cells that are inside the human body. Thermo Fisher Scientific's QDOT patent, U.S. patent 0228565A1, provides details on how, and now I'm going to read 3 points about the patent, but I want to make an observation before I read those 3 points. Most of us are probably, I'm guessing, are probably not familiar with Thermo Fisher Scientific. That's Bill Gates.
Oh, is it really?
Yep.
Okay.
So QDOT, remember that's quantum dots, creates an ionic charge to penetrate the cell wall in the nucleus of cells. QDOT uses FISH and SIRS, we'll explain those later, to target, extract, analyze, and sequence cells' DNA. QDOT performs gene editing inside human cells using CRISPR and other gene editing technologies to delete and replace partial gene sequences in order to permanently alter the DNA of cells inside our bodies in the human genome. So let's pause there. Hampton, you remember just last week and the week before that when we covered the chapter on genetics in the Evolution's Achilles Heels book. That was, wasn't that revealing?
Yeah, a lot of discussion of mRNA type stuff.
Yes, and how particularly it's 4D, not 2D.
Right.
So just replacing a few what we call letters or codons in your genome is not as simple. You're not going to get the direct result you thought you were going to get. That's going to affect lots of other things.
Right. Unintended consequences.
Exactly. So I am just, and I'm certain that the proprietors of this information, you know, the companies and the researchers, they know that. Why are they operating on the assumption it's 2D if they know it's 4D? That's just baffling to me. But let me read on. No wonder Bill Gates's Thermo Fisher Scientific and global billionaires want to keep this patent a trade secret and block public access. And then she has a picture of the patent and she goes, good thing I saved a copy of it here. Then she goes on again. I'm scrolling through this. What I'm passing over are pictures of everything she's saying. You know, they're pictures of the patents. They're pictures of the pictures in the patents, right? So you're seeing the molecules. Thermo Fisher Scientific, which is also called Life Technologies, is the owner of the intellectual property described, you know, U.S. patent number, blah, blah, blah. Thermo Fisher allowed the QDOT patent to expire in order to convert the QDOT intellectual property to a trade secret. Here's why they did that. Patents, citizens of the U.S. have access to patents, but they don't have access to trade secrets. So they let the patent expire. You know, who knows when they developed this technology, maybe 10 years ago, or well, 2012. I'm looking at it right here. So they let that expire so that you don't have access to it anymore. She does, but we don't. Because now it's a business trade secret. That's why they wanted to do that, because you don't have access to that. So that she just explains what I just said in the next paragraph. So here's, she then has a note. When the FDA approved Pfizer's mRNA COVID-19 vaccines on August 23rd, 2021, Pfizer's EUA, that's emergency use agreement, shield was broken and Pfizer had 2 weeks to fully disclose the AI biotechnology that's in the shots. Unless all of America, including attorneys, could be convinced that the FDA approval didn't really happen. See, she's tongue-in-cheek referring to how they got around having to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It was approved. And once it's approved, then all the rules apply. And so they're contesting. It wasn't really approved. It's all still emergency use, you know. Well, it isn't, but nobody's pushing that too hard. So per the patent, Thermo Fisher Scientific branded and registered, trademarked all quantum dots, semiconductor nanocrystals, and nanocrystal technologies as Q-Dot. And then here's the pictures of all the patents that, you know, did that. Nanotechnologies made with graphene oxide, such as the single-walled carbon nanotubules that encapsulate Q-Dot, are semiconductor technologies. Semiconductor nanotechnologies can conduct and host electromagnetic fields and are strong receptors for electromagnetic pulses, signals, and EMP attacks. Now, why would they be putting that in the vaccine?
I have no idea.
Yeah, so you can receive electromagnetic impulses from them. They want to control you, and they want to track you. That's why that's in there. So graphene oxide also has tremendous strength. It's really a phenomenal molecule. I mean, you just wish it was used for good. Mm-hmm. Instead of even, it's 50% stronger than titanium. It can be as thin as one atom thick. Is that remarkable? And still 50% stronger than titanium?
Yeah.
It's an unbelievable. So they use it, of course, in military, right, for armor and so on. I'm sure they use it for a lot of other things. Q-Dot emits ultraviolet and infrared radiation, causing cell death, cancer, and even microwave radiation inside the body. Again, all of this, none of this is she making up. She's just writing a simple sentence to explain what you read in the picture of the patent and so on. Q-Dot targets and labels organs, tissues, and cells inside the human body. Trillions of Q-Dot were injected into each American adult or child that received a COVID-19 vaccine. So then it gets into that fish and the SIRS thing. We don't need to read all that. I mean, I like it. It's interesting, but we don't need that for our purposes this morning.
Wow.
I know. So yeah, I'll probably just wrap it up there, but that's...
What's that got to do with our chapter?
Well, so it gets into it's how they're using the mRNA. Mm-hmm. The mRNA does not, it breaks down outside the human cell almost instantly. It's a fragile molecule, and it can't penetrate your cell membranes on its own. So with this nanotechnology, you know, that polarizes, it's got an ionic charge, so it polarizes your membrane, so then it can just slip right in. So, and then once the mRNA gets inside the cell nucleus, is it not even just the cell membrane, it can get in the nuclear membrane and gets in there and then copies, you know, your genome. And then splices. This goes into great detail on the CRISPR technology. I'm just not reading it all. But how they're replacing your genes with other genes. So they want you, like partially AI, artificially intelligent, so that they can control you. By the way, I'm not going to take the time to look it up right now, but this was in September. I want to say September 21st. I'm not exactly sure the date, but it was in September. Biden pass an executive order on pursuing AI in this country. And within that order, he makes the claim most people in the United States already have this in them. Now, what do you think he was referring to?
The vaccine. Graphene oxide stuff?
Yeah, the graphene oxide stuff in the vaccine. He said, you've already got it in you. If you're sitting there thinking, well, I didn't put any of that in my body. Yes, you did, if you got that vaccine. And by the way, let's not be confused on, oh, I got the J&J, not the Moderna. There's none of that matters, because all of them are operating under the master patent, which was granted to Moderna. And by the way, go look up Moderna's history. How did Moderna already become the dominant player in the vaccine field? That company's only, it's not very old. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the vehicle that these, you know, the powers that be wanted to carry all this information. So anyway, Pfizer, J&J, all that, they operate under the Moderna patent. So it's in all of them. Doesn't matter which one you got.
Yeah.
So anyway, studying about how to defeat the arguments of evolution has great benefit to understanding the world around us. And to back up further from that, here's why. Evolution is the dominant view of Western culture, the dominant worldview. Well, in that case, why not pursue AI? Because part of evolution, yeah, it's a logical extension of that philosophy. There's no God in that philosophy. Why don't we just engineer ourselves to speed the process of evolution, as it were? So that's where all of this is coming from. That's why we're spending time tearing down the arguments of evolution. And we've seen, you know, in chapter one of this book, that natural selection is not powerful enough to have created what Darwinists think it created. Chapter two, the genetics chapter, no way does a real understanding of modern genetics comport with evolution. Not even close. And now chapter three, we're going to talk about like the biochemical basis of all this stuff. So it's a chemistry chapter. The real import is the origin of life, right? Well, how did it start? Because all these arguments presuppose living cells. Well, how did we get the first living cell?
Right.
That's what this
natural selection needs something to select.
Exactly. So that was our introduction to chapter three. I'm not sure we're going to be able to cover all of it because you have a habit of rabbit trailing me, Hampton.
Okay.
But let me read who our author of chapter three is. This is Dr. Jonathan Sarfati. He's a PhD in physical chemistry, works in New Zealand. Dr. Sarfati is renowned in creationist circles, having published a tremendous number of articles and four solo books, as well as being co-author of several more books. One of these books, Refuting Evolution, is the number one best-selling creationist book ever. His penetrating logic shines through his works, perhaps stemming from his chess expertise. He was awarded the title of FIDE Master in 1980. I don't know what that is. I don't have any idea of the chess world, but apparently the guy's a big chess player. Jonathan was chosen to write on the third Achilles heel of Darwinian evolution, The Origin of Life. Here he brings his considerable wit to bear on the insurmountable problem of the rise of the first living things from non-living precursors. So let's put our chemistry hats on and dive in. This will cure Hampton. This is the perfect cure for my malaise about the vaccine. Don't you think So I'm going to rabbit trail us. Don't you think Jesus is coming back really soon?
Sure seems like it.
It does. And I understand all the theological caution about that. I still think that's going to happen very soon. And I mean very soon in our terms, because when you say very soon in God's terms, that might be a while. But
Right.
very soon in our terms, I think. So, okay. How about this is a difficult chapter, don't you think?
I thought it was very complicated.
Okay. So the best way maybe to approach that is let me start off reading, and I'm going to go about a page. This is his introduction. And there's a sense in which, if we can cover the introduction, see the rest of his chapter is just explaining his introduction.
Right.
You know what I mean? So let's do that. Does that remind you of a biblical book?
Well, I can't think of.
So for me, the Gospel of John, the first 18 verses,
Okay.
you've read everything he has to say. The rest of that gospel is explaining those first 18 verses.
Okay.
That's pretty clear, actually. So see, this guy's like the biblical author John, who, by the way, is often lauded as a literary genius. I think there's this common assumption that, the authors of the Bible were peasants and, just putting stuff down there.
Fishermen, right?
Yeah, fish, exactly. Fishermen and yeah, read their stuff, read it really closely, and you'll find we don't even get close to that kind of literature today. They're phenomenal. So anyway, here's Sarfati's introduction. The previous chapter discussed the problems that genetics poses for evolution, but even those arguments were most generous to evolution because they presuppose a self-reproducing cell with a functioning genetic system. The chapter before that, on natural selection, was likewise generous, since those arguments can only work only with the pre-existence of entities that can pass on any information selected. The present chapter will up the ante considerably. We will see what would be required for that initial reproducing system to come into being on its own. I think that paragraph's pretty clear.
Right.
So, next, you're about to discover that the origin of first life is a glaring Achilles heel for materialists. Even the simplest living single-celled organism is extremely complex, including numerous complex machines and the instructions to build them, all stored in a way that can be both decoded for use by the organism and passed on to its offspring. The simplest theorized reproducing organism would require numerous proteins and molecular machines and a way to code and store the information needed to manufacture them. Is it possible for such a cell to evolve from chemical precursors? So let's pause there. That was the second paragraph. Anything in there you want to point out?
No, that
Okay.
was clear.
Okay. I want to point something out. The language is not, well, the language is clear, but the images are not powerful enough. When he says, for instance, even in the quote simplest organisms, they have complex machinery. Just how complex? It's mind-blowing, right? Like, compare it to an automobile. The simplest living cell is infinitely more complex than an automobile.
Right, and that was the Darwin's black box book.
Exactly, that was Behe. So, like one of the things we didn't talk about in Behe, but always just really stuck with me. I've read that book a couple times, He did talk about like the flagella on a bacterium. Well, what we didn't go into is, oh, so it has a little tail like flipper. No. It actually has a device on there that cleans that flipper periodically, goes up and down, takes off any debris. Imagine if your automobile had that. You don't have to take it into the shop and have a mechanic work, right? It
Right.
cleans its pistons on its own, blah, blah, blah. That's how complex this stuff is. And then imagine your car could reproduce, right? In
Right.
a couple of years, all of a sudden now you got two or three cars. It's and feed itself. You don't have to take it to the gas station. I mean, it's mind-blowing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And how these people think that that could have just happened without an intelligent designer is ludicrous. So, next paragraph. In every known self-reproducing organism on Earth today, DNA stores biological information, but that information can't be read without decoding machinery. The instructions to build this decoding machinery are themselves stored on the DNA. Is it possible to solve this vicious chicken and egg problem? Furthermore, most of these processes use energy supplied by ATP, produced by the nanomotor ATP synthase. But the ATP synthase motor can't be produced without instructions in the DNA, read by decoding machinery using ATP, a three-way circle, or perhaps an egg nymph grasshopper problem. Is there a solution to this perplexing conundrum, or does it signal to us that the origin of life as we know it is impossible? What do you think?
Yes, that seems impossible.
So, and think about that language, right? He's not saying, oh, it's, doesn't have a very good chance or probably isn't true. Impossible.
Yeah.
So, next little paragraph. Some propose to solve these problems by having one type of molecule function as both the information storage retrieval system and the decoding machinery. But how does the most common candidate, RNA, measure up to the requirements of first life? Furthermore, undirected chemistry in a hypothetical primordial soup would have no chance of achieving even this minimal complexity. The alleged building blocks, those are amino acids, would not build the necessary long molecules needed for life. Rather, the long molecules would break down. Many of the building blocks would not form at all, or would be too dilute and contaminated to be useful, and would be a mixture of left and right-handed forms instead of the exclusively one-handed forms used by living organisms. Do these facts spell the end of all origin of life scenarios? Yes, they do.
Yes.
But fine. Do you know what that left-handed, right-handed stuff is?
No, I don't.
Well, there's spin on electrons. And it basically the shorthand term left-handed, right-handed is a very good way to describe it. So all of those molecules inside a living cell are all one-sided, but in nature, two-sided are everywhere, like both of them, left and right-handed. Well, how did that happen? How did it all of a sudden the living cell got all one way? That's what he's saying. Finally, chemical evolution studies, both in the test tube and through computer simulations, involve unacceptable levels of interference from an intelligent investigator. Can these be submitted as evidence for the origin of life? So he'll go through later on in this chapter some of those examples. Oh, look, we sent an electric charge, which would represent lightning, into this soup stuff we've prepared in the petri dish. And look, two chemicals got together. That's what he's saying. Well, that's all controlled by people.
Right. It took intelligence.
Yes, to manipulate it. Yeah, and even then, they're not really getting any results. But well,
he does mention later on, I think, somewhere that they set up an experiment and they create something, you know, label it A, and then they create something in another experiment labeled B, but those are in two separate soups, if you will, that would destroy the other one.
Yeah.
And so there's no way A and B could ever get together because...
Yeah, he goes through that in detail. It's so good. It's, you can see the absurdity of it. But what's driving them? What's driving the materialists? Because, you know, we see the absurdity of it, but they don't go to work in the morning thinking, you know, I'm really doing something absurd today. Why? What's driving them? Why don't they reach the same conclusions we do?
Because of their materialistic faith.
100%. It's their worldview. Remember, they wake up thinking there is no God. So we're going to find out how this happened.
Yeah.
So that's how they're working. So then the last paragraph here of his introduction. To top it all off, leading researchers admit that chemical evolution is accepted not due to facts and evidence, but because of a materialistic faith. How can this then stand as evidence against the Bible's claim that an intelligent being created life through an act of divine fiat? So when the materialists criticize believers' faith, what about their faith? Because they have it. In spades, they have it. And it's called, there is no God. That's not a fact. That's their faith. They don't believe that because they have evidence of that. They just postulate it as...
Well, I guess if they don't have evidence, then it's blind faith.
There you go. So they just don't want you to look at it that way. So anyway, where do you want to dive in after that?
Well, I thought that was interesting. He talked about Darwin struggling with the origin of life.
Yeah.
And so he was aware of Louis Pasteur debunking spontaneous generation. And so, you know, he struggled with that. And he had several different things that he had written where he, you know, speculated on different things, but he never did come up with a solution.
No. And let's read the little section on Anthony Flew, because that's in the section you're talking about. And it's good insight, Hampton, into, you know, I tend to paint these guys with such a broad brush, you know, oh, you're, it's ludicrous, right? You're wrong. You're a fool. Well, obviously I know Proverbs, right? The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. So there's clearly a foolish motivation, but they're not non-thinkers, right? Their thinking is darkened, but they are thinkers. So Here's an example. Here's an example. Famous guy, Anthony Flew, died in 2010. So let's read his little section because it's interesting. Thus, even Darwin, father of modern evolutionary theory, halted between two opinions on the most important topic of all. How did life begin? The famous philosopher Anthony Flew pointed out the problem directly, addressing the claims of the leading atheistic evolutionist Richard Dawkins. It seems to me, so this is quoting Anthony Flew, it seems to me that Richard Dawkins constantly overlooks the fact that Darwin himself, in the 14th chapter of The Origin of Species, pointed out that this whole argument began with a being which already possessed reproductive powers. This is the creature, the evolution of which a truly comprehensive theory of evolution must give some account. Darwin himself was well aware that he had not produced such an account. It now seems to me that the findings of more than 50 years of DNA research have provided materials for a new and enormously powerful argument to design. Not evolution. Design. That's Anthony Flew's way of saying Behe's argument is irrefutable. Okay, next paragraph. This is especially notable because Dr. Flew was, until recently, known as a leading proponent of atheism. But he abandoned this belief prior to his death, to the consternation of the atheistic community. One major factor in his decision was the enormous complexity of even the simplest self-reproducing cell. So you can see it does
affect. I remember that.
Yeah, it does affect them. You know, they do understand the arguments. They're just not just going to draw the right conclusion. But they do understand in their honest moments that there's no way this could have happened without a designer. And they've, you know, they draw some comfort from saying, you know, designer instead of God of the Bible. But that's what they're referring to. So yeah. I thought that was interesting.
There's a lot of pushback even against the intelligent design crowd, because they know where that leads.
Right. They like we've said before, there's only two games in town, right? So materialism or a creator, and they cannot stomach the fact that there's a creator. So that's how it works. So next section. You want to look at anything in there?
Chemical evolution.
Yeah. Or just
talk about abiogenesis.
Okay. Cool. So let's.
How would you define that?
Well, just this, the same way he does. So let's read a little bit. Many evolutionists will try to dismiss the strong evidence in this chapter by claiming that origin of life from non-living chemicals has nothing to do with evolution, and claim that abiogenesis is the correct term for the former. So origin of life not having to do with evolution. That's abiogenesis. But their fellow evolutionist, Gordy Slack, rebukes them for that. So let's just read Gordy Slack, and then maybe that'll cover this chapter or this section. I think it is disingenuous to argue that the origin of life is irrelevant to evolution. It's no less relevant than the Big Bang is to physics or cosmology. Evolution should be able to explain, in theory at least, all the way back to the very first organism that could replicate itself through biological or chemical processes. And to understand that organism fully, we would simply have to know what came before it. And right now, we are nowhere close. Yeah, nowhere close as in infinitely nowhere close. You can't get life from nothing. Yeah. So, right, we've said that before. You can't get something from nothing. And by the way, even this, even origin of life has a prior question. Because they're going to talk about like the chemicals. Well, what kind of, well, where'd the chemicals come from? Mm-hmm. Right. See, you can push it back one more step. And again, it's always compelling. If the universe is not eternal, which everyone knows, the universe hasn't always been here. It had a beginning. Well, how can you get something from nothing? There has to be a creator. Mm-hmm. Has to be. So that's what they're up against. So they'll do all sorts of, you know, gyrations and tricks to try to get out from underneath that logical conclusion, but they're never going to be able to escape it. So next little paragraph, maybe the simple cell. I'm not going to read that because we've said that so many times. It's not simple in the least. It's unbelievably complex. So anyway, then the next section covers, I have almost this whole thing underlined. I know it just doesn't even do any good to underline, because when everything's underlined, then that has the same value as nothing is underlined, right? Because nothing stands. So, but maybe just a little bit. This section is called information versus chemistry. That's an important distinction, because the defining characteristic of life is information, ultimately, right? That's what your genome is. It's information. So it's not just arranging chemicals and elements. It's somehow you have to account for information. So the previous chapter showed that DNA stores an enormous amount of coded information. Atheist Richard Dawkins himself has pointed out, so he's going to quote Dawkins, there's enough information capacity in a single human cell to store the Encyclopedia Britannica, all 30 volumes of it, three or four times over. It's actually way more than that, but just take that example. They know that. That's Dawkins saying that's the case. Then he goes on.
He said in a previous chapter, it was 870 Bibles stacked up.
Right. Yeah, it's hard to quantify it. It's not unlimited information, but it is so vast, you can't really qualify. In this, every cell of a human body, every cell of any living organism, the amount of information is just overwhelming.
And mixing a couple chemicals together is not going to create that.
No, it doesn't create information. That's exactly right. So then Dawkins goes on, the difference between life and non-life is a matter not of substance, but information. He's correct in saying that. Living things contain prodigious quantities of information. Most of the information is coded in DNA. So you have a four-letter alphabet. And with that four-letter alphabet, you just create nearly unlimited information. So then the author of this chapter picks it back up. Dawkins explains much of this by natural selection. But as shown, this will not work for the first living cell. It didn't work, by the way, even in natural selection, just to be clear. But that you can't explain the first cell that way. Thus, the explanations are restricted to chemistry. However, there's nothing in the chemistry of DNA's building blocks themselves that would make them join up in predetermined ways any more than forces between ink molecules make them join up into letters and words. That's so let's just, analogy. I was going to say, that's a really good analogy. So let's explain that. If you have some ink and a piece of paper, you're not going to get information from that. You're not going to get anything from that. What provides the information is the spreading of that ink in a predetermined way to communicate a message. But just the ink and just the paper don't produce anything. You need an intelligent source to
Well, if
then
you had
write.
enough, if you had enough years, then that tree could fall over and get smashed
Oh yeah, and it would splatter.
and become a piece of paper and
Yeah. And then you could that someone could knock the ink over and it could splatter. And even right, what would you get from that? Nothing. You'd get a splotch, right? So that I think that clarifies almost the entire discussion, right? You're not going to get information from chemicals. It's the arrangement of the chemicals into information that provides life. So later on here, he has a sentence, in all modern forms, information is created by an intelligent agent in order to convey a message. Life is based on information. All modern forms. You don't have information without intelligence, an intelligent source. No such thing. So, hence, there had to be a creator. It just almost sounds, doesn't it, like we're beating a dead horse?
It
There,
does.
it does. I apologize for that. I just hearken back to Paul saying, you know, we destroy arguments, right? So there's, if you imagine evolution as a wall, and you know, a stronghold, a fortress, what we're doing is taking that thing down brick by brick and smashing it to pieces. It didn't happen. It could not have happened. So I just really want to drive that home to people because that's going to form the basis of your worldview. And if you're wrong on that fundamental aspect of your worldview, think how wrong you'll be on everything else. Here's the path you could walk down if you believe in evolution. You could ultimately say, well, we're just chemical machines. So why don't we edit our genes? Why don't we hasten evolution in ourselves? And if we have to kill off 4 or 5 billion people, who cares? There's no God. We're not going to be judged for doing that. What's the difference between killing 4 and 5 billion people and swatting some mosquitoes? So that's what we're going to do. And that's what you're seeing before your very eyes. And it all stems from the belief that there is no God. So we evolved. That's how we got here. And it's all entirely wrong, demonstrably wrong. So,
Well, the next section is the chicken and egg dilemma.
yeah, he says it's not going to go away no matter what you
No,
say. But we're
that's
familiar with
mostly
that.
just a repetition of the intro.
Yes, exactly right. And then amazing machines, right? So we've covered that. That's how information gets processed, is these machines. So, you know, I love the biochemistry of all this. I love what the ribosomes do and all and the RNA and all that, but we don't need to read that. I suggest it for everybody, but go take some biology classes, go read some books. It won't advance the argument. It just makes the argument more clear. So then he goes into energy, you know, how do you provide energy? How does the cell appropriate energy? And that's fascinating stuff. ATP synthase, how do we get all that? And then he has a little picture, not little, I guess, half a page of the ATP synthase in the E. coli. You can see how complex that stuff is. It's their motor, right? It's how they produce energy. It's just jaw-dropping how complex it is and how it works so efficiently. So good reading, but not something we're gonna dwell on.
He gets into some stuff later on with a guy named Wolfenden
Yeah.
and talking about phosphates and he starts throwing out numbers like 10 to the 21st, which is what the number of zeros after the 10, right?
Yeah, we don't have words for those size of numbers.
No, we
It's not
don't.
a.
But you know what I think? What I feel like is that when you throw out a 10 with a number after it, I think people think that there's a chance. Okay. And, I don't know how many zeros it takes before there's no chance, and maybe it's, six, or maybe it's two zeros, or, whatever, one in a million. Okay. So, if you know your chance of winning the lottery is one in 500 trillion, are you going to buy a lotto ticket, or, 5,000 zeros, whatever that number is? And these are the kind of numbers they throw out. And so it's deceiving, because I just think that people don't see that and go, impossible. They actually see that and think, well, there's a chance.
I think one helpful, exactly right. But one helpful comparison is what he does, by quantifying it to something you might be able to begin to wrap your brain around. So when he says, the chances of producing these proteins is 10 to the 5,000 and or fi what is that number? 5,000 zeros. Okay. That's what you're referring to. You can't comprehend that. But imagine this comparison. In the entire universe, there are 10 to the 80th atoms. So
So
N
the chance
to
is
the
10 to the
5,000th compared to 10 to the 80th, right? And even that number, 10 to the 80th, you cannot comprehend that. And they're talking about something that would take 10 to the 5,000th. But even that's fiction. There's not any chance that it would have. There's zero. You might as well say 10 to the 80 billionth. There is no chance that it could have happened. To put those kind of numbers on it, like you're saying, is almost deceptive.
Yes, that's it. It's deceiving. It's deceptive to say that, because they just should say it's impossible. They don't need to give us 10 to the 5,000th, or 10 to the 80, or 10 to the 12. I mean,
And so let's give a flesh and blood example. So here's Fred Hoyle, famous scientist, died in 2001. So the famous cosmogonist, Sir Fred Hoyle, 1915 to 2001, abandoned his atheism when he considered the absurdly small probabilities. So here's a quote from Hoyle. The likelihood of the formation of life from inanimate matter is one to a number with 40,000 noughts after it, is big enough to bury Darwin and the whole theory of evolution. There was no primeval soup, neither on this planet nor any other. And if the beginnings of life were not random, they must therefore have been the product of a purposeful intelligence. Used to be an atheist, looking at this stuff critically and honestly, decides had to be a designer. Well, anyone would decide that, looking at this. So,
if you're honest with the information.
exactly. So then, let alone getting into, self-replicating molecules. Imagine the amount of information that goes on in that process. So anyway, and then he talks, then a whole big section on the RNA world. Ooh, that's cool, Hampton. And there you see your right-handed, left-handed stuff. See the picture of that on page 100?
Let me get the yes.
Yeah. So that's what he was saying. Well, how did we get all one way if in nature it's found both ways? So anyway, then he goes through some people propose, proteins came first, blah, blah, blah. And he goes through these experiments, like you said, Miller and Urey. That's often referred to. I don't know if I want to read that. Maybe we should, because that experiment's often referred to. How about we dive into that one? Because that comes up in conversations.
Okay.
So this is page 102, the Miller-Urey experiments. So let's read this so people know when that comes up, you have a full understanding of what this really was. Stanley Miller, 1930 to 2007, was a graduate student of Harold Urey, who had won the 1934 Nobel Prize for Chemistry for discovering deuterium. That's heavy hydrogen. Miller and Urey filled a sealed glass apparatus with the reducing gases methane, ammonia, and hydrogen, but excluded oxidizing gases like oxygen. They're controlling it right off the bat, right? There's an intelligent source, a Nobel Prize winner, in fact, controlling the environment.
Right.
But anyway, so that's what they did. They put these reducing gases in a glass container. There was also a flask of boiling water to supply water and drive the gases to circulate past a 60,000 volt sparking device designed to simulate lightning. The gas mixture also passed through a water-cooled condenser so that any reaction products would be collected by falling into a water trap below. After a week, they found a red stain in the trap. Most of this was an insoluble, toxic, and carcinogenic mixture called tar or resin, a common product in organic reactions. In this tar, they found a small amount of amino acids. However, these were mainly the simplest amino acids, glycine and alanine, and the yields were a tiny 1.05% and 0.75%, respectively. Miller admitted the total yield was small for the energy expended. Yet there was no evidence that the situation would improve with longer time. The tiny yields of simple products seemed to be as much as the simulation would ever achieve. It's ironic to look at the assumptions made, the repeated experimentation completed, and even the contraption manufactured to create a tiny yield of only a few amino acids that could not produce life in any sense, and proclaim no intelligence was required for the origin of life. In effect, Miller and Urey discovered that random chemical reactions produce random chemicals. And
That's
yet
not
the
how it was portrayed by
portrayed
the news.
exactly right. Exactly right. Yet the chemicals produced were also simple. A random collection of simple molecules is the opposite of what life requires. So he goes into more detail about that stuff, but they didn't create anything even remotely approaching what you would need for life. So, but those experiments are often, thrown out in conversation. Oh, they proved such and such. They didn't. They didn't. And there was intelligence involved the entire way.
Right.
So, okay, let's see how to wrap this up. Again, he's going over.
But he does have a little section later on there where what I mentioned, of common procedures to find a trace of compound A
Yeah, no, exactly right.
and then
That's
a
right.
compound B in another simulation, but they're in mutually incompatible conditions. They couldn't, A
Correct.
and B would never both appear in the same pond, if you will.
Correct. Good observation. Now I want to read this one little section. It's on page 106. This is very helpful. It starts near the top. The more we understand. The paragraph that starts that way. So, the more we understand about biochemistry, the more we learn how different it is from abiotic chemistry. So, those are biochemistry and abiotic chemistry. So the chemistry of life versus the chemistry of chemicals. The laws are the same, but chemistry outside the living cell is always dirty mass action chemistry, while biochemistry is pure single molecule chemistry. So he's going to explain the significance of that. The term dirty comes from chemical evolutionist and Nobel laureate Christian De Duve. It is merely a statement of fact that chemistry in the non-living world involves many molecules at a time and invariably includes contaminants. The theistic evolutionary paleontologist Simon Conway Morris called the product of typical origin of life experiments muck, goo, and gunk, echoing chemical evolutionist Graham Cairn Smith's term grossly contaminated gunks. Like the Miller-Urey stuff. It's just gunk. There's nothing even approaching life in there. And those are their terms. That's not me, little swim coach Bob, saying that because I don't have the vocabulary to describe chemical processes. They don't either. It's just gunk, according to them. Indeed, modern industrial chemistry with carefully planned processes can't normally achieve purities above 99.99%. I'd say that's outstanding if they can get that far. But it's very difficult for them to get purity in their chemical reactions, even when it's all controlled by intelligent sources. This is largely because it deals with huge numbers of molecules at a time. But chemistry can achieve better because each enzyme, but biochemistry, so that's life inside a cell, can achieve better because each enzyme manipulates one molecule at a time. Its products are then taken care of by the next enzyme in the right shape and right place. In the end, the chemistry of the cell is precise, constrained, controlled, and functional, and life could not exist without it being this way. See, if you have what's called like a dirty cell, that's death. You'll die. Your body, I mean, what's going on in our bodies, Hampton, even as we speak, is almost unimaginable, right? In every cell in your body, it's cleaning itself. It's producing energy without pollution. You know what I mean? It's unbelievably active. And if that were not the case, you'd die. And even we, our chemists, you know, our industrial chemists, they can't approach that kind of purity. Well, right. How did we get that in the first place then? So anyway.
Yeah. The next section, you were talking about wrapping it up. This might be a good way, but it's chemical evolution, evidence or blind faith.
Sure.
And he says, the non-creationist information theorist Hubert Yockey made a very revealing comment 30 years ago. And he quote, research on the origin of life seems to be unique in that the conclusion has already been authoritatively accepted. What remains to be done is to find the scenarios which describe the detailed mechanisms and processes by which this happened. And then the author goes back to, this is important to keep in mind when reading popular accounts of evolution or in response to those who claim believers in design are biased. Dr. Yockey finished his paper with, one must conclude that contrary to the established and current wisdom, a scenario describing the genesis of life on Earth by chance and natural causes, which can be accepted on the basis of fact, and not faith, has not yet been written.
Yes, there you go. So then he has another section, you know, where's the evidence? Don't have any. So here, let me just read this and maybe we'll end it here, Hampton.
Yeah.
I'm page 110. I think there's the last paragraph before "Where does this lead?" which introduces, you know, the fossil record, the next chapter. But the last paragraph is so good. Again, hearkening back to what we've mentioned before, we are told in our culture, particularly concerning the vaccine, oh, you need to go with the science. Okay, let's go with the science. Let's read this paragraph. In essence, the laws of physics, chemistry, and probability disagree with the abiotic origin of life hypothesis. So if we're just going with the science, there was no origin of life apart from God, strictly based on the science. So if you want to just go with the science, then let's do that 100%.
Well, he makes the point, it's not biblical creationists who are appealing to a God of the gaps argument here. He's basically, this book is showing all the gaps in the science argument.
Right. So
but they control the conversation, and that God of the gaps.
They're pros at that.
You know, catchy phrase.
Yeah, that's their skill. Their skill is rhetoric. It's not science. It's rhetoric. The way they frame stuff, what they assume, and so on. It's just rhetoric. They don't have the science on their side. In fact, let's finish with Sarfati. In fact, our contention is that an intelligent creator God who exists outside the universe and is the cause of the universe is the only reasonable conclusion when faced with what we have learned through centuries of experimental science. He's right.
Yeah.
He's right. Well, I started out today, Hampton, just so discouraged over the evil in the world. We discussed a little bit before we started recording. Yeah, I can't comprehend how God can view that evil and maintain his essence. And he's going to intervene soon.
Yeah.
I think.
Okay. Well, I guess we did finish the chapter.
Very good. That's good work for us.
Okay. Well, I will talk to you next time.
Thanks, Hampton.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Therefore, I exhort you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a sacrifice, alive, holy, and pleasing to God, which is your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to this present world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may test and approve what is the will of God, what is good and well-pleasing and perfect.